So I want to talk to you about some phases that I find very interesting called symmetry protected topological phases, or just SPTs. I want to talk to you about their thermal stability and connections to fault-tolerant quantum computation. And this is work done with Benny and Alex and Stephen. And Benny's there, and so he comprises most of the audience already. So we'll try and make it maybe a bit more informal and just, yeah. Feel free to ask questions and heckle as much as you like. It's good practice. So as I mentioned, I want to talk to you about SPT order. I think they're pretty, it's an interesting topic right at the intersection of condensed matter physics and quantum information. And I think while they're fascinating in their own right, I think the thing that really excites me is all the progress in recent years that are connecting them to quantum information and quantum computation. I think there's been a lot of work that gives them a really firm grounding within within the quantum info community. And so before we get to the questions that we're trying to answer in this talk, perhaps I'll just motivate you know, the setup that we're talking about, what SPT phases are, what some of their applications are, and hopefully it'll justify you coming to this talk. Of course, many of you will be probably already familiar with the setup. It's the great many-body phases of matter. So we consider placing spins in some d dimensions. So we have some arrangement of spins, each with a finite dimensional local vector space. And usually it's convenient to think about placing these spins on a lattice. So they could be at the vertices of a lattice or the edges of a face or whatever. The lattice just gives some structure to the problem that we're looking at. And so of course, with all these local degrees of freedom, we can think of them as just qubits. The entire Hilbert space is given by this tensor product structure here. And the types of Hamiltonians that we consider are local Hamiltonians. So this means the Hamiltonian is the sum of terms, each which acts only on a which acts non-trivially only on a ball of constant radius, such as this term up here, where it's constant independent of the size of the system. And so we're interested in studying the zero temperature quantum phases for such Hamiltonians, or the ground space properties, or the low energy properties of these systems. And broadly speaking, when we think of when we look at the spectrum of such a system, there are two possibilities. It can be either gapped or gapless. It's like the most broad kind of coarse level description that we can give. And we're interested in gapped phases of matter because they're slightly easier, but still surprisingly rich. So you can consider gapless phases of matter, and they're still very interesting, but maybe in many cases they're harder to study. So, and what I mean by a gapped phase of matter is that if we look at the difference in energy between the ground state and the first excited space, there's a finite gap which persists in the limit of infinite system size. So there's going to be some gap between the ground space and the first excited space, and it doesn't close even when we take the infinite limit. And then, of course, if it were to close or become arbitrarily small, then we say it's gapless. And then we want to sort of broadly classify what type of gapped phases of matter we can have. So we want to group together systems of, you know, that have similar macroscopic properties. We want to not worry about fine details, and we call this a phase of matter. And I'll define that more carefully here. So what exactly do we mean by a phase of matter? There's many definitions that you could give. Some of them are, you know, many of them are approximately equivalent, but maybe there's some still interesting problems there to work out the equivalence between all the definitions. But this is the definition that we choose, and it's based on the entanglement properties of the ground state. So a phase of matter is just an equivalence class of ground states where the equivalence relation is up to a local unitary or constant depth quantum circuit. So we say two states belong to the same phase if and only if they can be related by a quantum circuit whose depth is constant in the system size. So there's a quantum circuit here. Each of the gates acts only on a finite region. And then we have some number of layers of these simultaneous gates, and then this number of layers is constant in the system size. And most of the time, you can relax constant to sublinear without worrying too much about, you know, most of the results still hold true. Maybe Courtney has something to say on that, but
Sub-poly is better.
Sub-poly, yeah, okay. And then we can define the trivial phase, which is just all the states that are equivalent to a product state. So these are short-range entangled states that don't have too much entanglement. You can map each state in the trivial phase approximately to a product state. And then we say that anything that's not in the trivial phase is topologically ordered. So these are states that you can't map to a product state under a constant depth circuit. And such states you might think of as toric code words or ground states of the toric code. They're the classic example. But we don't have to consider just, I mean, we can consider putting more constraints on this definition. So physical systems often have symmetries. It's very natural to think about symmetries in physical systems. And so we can get a finer kind of class of phases if we impose some symmetry. And so it'll turn out that even with the trivial phase, if you impose some symmetry, you can get much richer phases. The trivial phase can break up into more than just one phase under symmetries. So more formally, this gives rise to the idea of a SPT phase or symmetry protected topological ordered states. So we have some gapped Hamiltonian. It has these symmetries, S1, S2, S3. And I'm really thinking about them as just some unitary operators. And I'm thinking about them as symmetries of, internal symmetries of the system. So there could be some spin flip or something like this, like an Ising symmetry, a rotation symmetry or a spin flip symmetry. They're just some operators. We can consider more general symmetries like translational invariance and time reversal symmetry. But for now, it's easiest just to think about, say, an Ising symmetry. And these S operators form a group. And they're symmetry of the system if they just commute with the Hamiltonian. And then we'll say a gapped ground state is SPT ordered if it satisfies two conditions. The first is that it's short-range entangled. So we can find some unitary, some constant depth unitary. And I'll probably, from now on, just refer to constant depth unitary circuits as just local unitaries. So we can find some local unitary which maps the state to a product state, such as a computational basis state. So that's the first condition. It basically means that the states we consider are trivial to begin with. But then the second requirement, which means that it's non-trivial SPT order or belongs to a non-trivial SPT phase, is that there's no symmetric constant depth circuit that can map this state to a product state. So in the presence of symmetries, you can't find a local unitary where each of the gates commutes with these symmetry operators that maps it to a product state. So put another way, SPT states are just short-range entangled states where you can find a local unitary that maps it to a product state, but any such unitary must break the symmetry. And the simplest example is this 1D cluster state. So the interesting part about SPT phases is that you can't have genuine topologically ordered phases in one dimension, but for SPT ordered phases you can. So the simplest example is this 1D cluster state. So we have a spin chain, qubits on each of the blue and green sides, and we'll just think about periodic boundary conditions for simplicity. And the Hamiltonian is just the sum of these commuting cluster terms. So we have one for each qubit. It has x on the qubit and then z on the neighboring qubits. All of these terms commute. So they have a unique ground state called the cluster state, which satisfies, it's the plus one eigenstate of all of these cluster terms. And this ground state, the cluster state, is short-range entangled. So I can prepare this by just first initializing all my qubits in the plus state and then doing control z's between all the neighboring qubits. This gives a constant depth preparation. So without a symmetry, it's trivial. But then the cluster model has this Z2 cross Z2 unsigned symmetry. So it has two generators. One, the first is this X's on odd sides. And then the second generator is X's on even sides. And you can see that this is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Each of these operators commutes with those terms. The first requirement is to check that this circuit breaks the symmetry. You can see that each of these CZ gates doesn't commute with these symmetry operators.
So this circuit that we wrote down is not a symmetric preparation. And then you can prove that each any sublinear preparation must break the symmetry. So Eugene has a paper on this.
You need at least linear depth to prepare this symmetrically.
And then you can generalize this 1D example. There's a whole family of fixed point models called the group cohomology models from Chen and company. And the idea is that you can, for each, you can input a dimension and input a group, and then the formalism can produce a representative of each phase, SPT phase. And it's complete in one dimension and two dimension, and then probably in three, but I don't know. And then I haven't seen proof of such a statement. And then there's some arguments that it probably breaks down in higher dimensions, but I don't know of any lattice realizations with only on-site symmetries outside of the group cohomology formalism. So I'll mention these again later. But the thing to have in mind is really that this 1D cluster state is what I think of when I think of a SPT ordered state, the simplest example. Right, so before I get into the question, I just want to briefly outline three applications of SPT ordered states, three of the most salient ones that I think are pretty important. So the first one is this idea of computational phases of matter. So a relatively recent
observation is that this measurement-based quantum computation gives us a way of harnessing the entanglement in many-body systems in a very direct way.
So namely through single qubit measurements on an appropriate resource state, you can harness the full power of universal quantum computation. And that is provided you have the right resource state. But the question is, how do we find good resource states, and how do we prove they're universal? And in recent years, SPT ordered states have provided a very natural candidate for looking for these resource states. So I want to try and draw some analogy here where we know that topologically ordered states, such as the toric code, you know, if we have a non-chiral topological order, then we have a quantum code, an error-correcting quantum code. And then I want to try and, this correspondence is not strict, it's kind of slightly ill-defined, but in a similar way, SPT ordered states provide candidates for measurement-based quantum computation, universal resources. And not only are they universal, they're robust too. So the simplest example, again, is using this 1D cluster state. A primitive form of computation is to try and generate EPR pairs between distant sites. So take the cluster state, and we have this side is Bob, this side is Alice. And we want to generate through single-qubit measurements outside of Alice and Bob an EPR pair. Maximally entangled state. And so it turns out you do a simple calculation. You see I measure x in these bulk qubits, and then z on either side, and then up to a measurement outcome dependent unitary on Bob's side, we have a EPR state. So this works for the cluster state, but perhaps this depends critically on the fine details of the cluster model. You know, we know it's plus one eigenstate of all the terms. But it turns out this same procedure works for any state within the Z2 cross Z2 SPT phase. So you can do the same procedure. You just measure X in the bulk, Z on the outside. You do the same correction, and you can generate this EPR pair. So I think that's pretty nice. You don't need a precise description of your resource state. You rely on more coarser properties, just the fact that it belongs to some phase. And then you can use that for computation. So this is like a very simple form of computation, but it turns out you can generalize this and get some pretty strong results in two dimensions and higher. Well, two dimensions that you can have computation almost throughout a phase. And there's still a lot of ongoing work there. So Dominic Ells, Jacob Miller, and Robert Rausendorf, they have a lot of papers on this. And I think it's pretty interesting. I guess the last thing is this provides some like physical mechanism or some natural candidate of states, natural candidates for what we should look for resource states. And then the second application is due to Benny, and I think there's a pretty surprising application, which is you can use SPTs as a tool to construct transversal or fault-tolerant gates in topological codes. So this is a long out, you know, a very old problem to try and classify gates that you can do transversally or locality in a locality preserving way in a topological code. It turns out that many has used these SPT states to construct a framework to produce such gates. And so the starting observation is, well, first I'll start with the toric code. So we know that in the toric code we have string-like logicals, but what happens if I don't apply the whole logical operator, I just apply it in some region? What happens at the boundary? Well, it produces these anionic excitations on the boundary. But suppose we look at the 2D color code, for instance, where we have this transversal phase gate, where you apply phase and phase daggers in a certain way on the whole lattice, and this implements a transversal logical operation. What happens if we don't apply it to the whole lattice, but only to some region with a boundary? Well, we know in the bulk, it's a logical operator, so it must map the ground space to the ground space. But what happens on the boundary? Well, if you look at these kind of excitation, if you look in the excitation basis, so I'll call this state 0 if I measure the x placket and I get 1. And then if I measure the x placket and I get minus 1, I'll call that the 1 state. And in this, so this is like a kind of anion, like an excitation basis. If I apply this phase gate with a boundary, and then I look in this basis, I see that on this boundary, I've created a 1D SPT state. I've created the cluster state. And that's pretty interesting. And where does the symmetry come from? Well, the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry comes from this parity constraints amongst anions. So you can only produce anions in pairs. This translates to a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry on this boundary. And so that's the starting observation. But then Benny turned it around and said, let's not create SPT states, but let's use SPT states to create transversal gates. And there's a framework there where you have a d-dimensional topological code, you use a d-1 dimensional SPT, and then you can construct a transversal gate or a locality preserving gate. And another interesting insight here is it gives new avenues for creating symmetries. This anion parity symmetry, which gives rise to this on-site symmetry in the 1D SPT phase. I think that's a nice observation. And then the third application is more of a condensed matter perspective, but it turns out that you think of these SPT states, they're kind of trivial in the bulk because they're short-range entangled, there's no anionic excitations. But if you put them on a lattice with a boundary, they always is not proven, but in all cases you check, it has protected modes, protected boundary modes. And what I mean by protected boundary modes depends on the dimension. But if you look at a 2D lattice with a 1D boundary, the 1D boundary must either break the symmetry or be gapless. If we look at a 3D system with a boundary, if the boundary theory doesn't break the symmetry and if it's gapped, then it must be topologically ordered. So this gives a new way to think about realizing exotic topological phases of matter on the boundary of a SPT. And then you actually get more richer phases than you would in 2D. So if we had a 3D system with a 3D SPT with a 2D boundary, turns out the type of phases you can get on this 2D boundary are more than what you could get in a standalone system. We call these anomalous. And then finally, you can play around with gauging and construct even more interesting SET, symmetry-enriched topological phases. And so there's lots of interplay and lots of connections with other phases of matter. Okay, so now we can get into the questions of the talk. So there's two questions, unless anyone has any questions on that introduction. Okay, so there's two questions that we sought out to answer. The first is, does it survive at non-zero temperature? So up till now, I've talked about ground state properties, zero temperature phases of matter. And the question is, can we have the same order survive at non-zero temperature in the equilibrium? And then do these associated computational structures remain? Do we still have protected boundary modes? Do we still have resources for measurement-based quantum computation and so on? And then the second question, which is not immediately clear how it's related to the first or related to SPT order at all, but it's why is the topological formulation of measurement-based quantum computation due to Rausendorf and company, why is it so good? So it has a really high threshold, and there's no seeming physical principle for what governs why it's so good, at least in my eyes. So I'll talk about this in the second part, so we'll kind of switch gears when we talk about this second question, and hopefully I'll know why it's connected to SPT order. And so, as I mentioned, it's kind of split into two parts. The first part is defining SPT order at non-zero temperature, what it means. And then the first result is to rule out the thermal stability of a large class of models, namely all these group cohomology models that I mentioned. And then the second part where we switch gears is to try and think about generalizing this correspondence, which is that SPT order states are useful for measurement-based quantum computation, to this correspondence and provide evidence for this correspondence, which is if we have thermally stable SPT order, then it should be useful for fault-tolerant measurement-based quantum computation. So that's the plan. And okay, let's get into it. So the first part is, how do we even define SPT order at non-zero temperature? So we're interested in the equilibrium system at inverse temperature beta. And this is, of course, given by the Gibbs ensemble, rho beta, which is just a mixture of all the eigenstates. Each state is weighted by the Boltzmann factor. And the question is, how non-trivial is it to prepare this state? So if we start with a classical ensemble is the Gibbs ensemble of a classical Hamiltonian, such as, just think of this non-interacting paramagnet here. We start with a classical ensemble. What's the circuit depth required to prepare our SPT state rho, where we're allowing some error, we don't have to prepare it exactly, and we're also allowing ancillaries. So the notion of our product state is replaced by a classical ensemble, and then we're really thinking about this zero temperature definition, which is the circuit complexity. So we can more precisely define this in the following way. So we give two parameters for how trivial a state is. So we want to say, how trivial is rho? Well, we give two numbers. First is R, which I'll call the depth, and then epsilon, which is the error. So let's try and unpack this definition a bit. So the first thing is we start with a classical ensemble on an enlarged space. So we tensor in additional degrees of freedom to find some classical ensemble. And then we're allowed access to a symmetric unitary of depth R. So we conjugate rho by U. And then we trace out the ancillary space and see how close we are to our original state. This is the one norm, so the trace norm. And so kind of intuitively, if it's R epsilon trivial for small r and small epsilon, then it's trivial. We should want, for a non-trivial state, we should want R to be, at least linear. Right. So is this definition okay? Yep.
Is it known if there exist examples of invertible SPT phases?
Invertible SPT phases? They're all invertible, I think.
Because it's like symmetry respecting invertible.
In what sense? So if I take two 1D phases to
an SPT phase, mm-hmm. a non-trivial SPT phase, there exists a state such that the local tensor product of them is
yep. trivial SPT
with the same symmetry.
Yep. They always exist.
For every SPT?
Yep.
And every state is trivial.
So we you're thinking about just tensoring on an additional ancilla? Yeah, so we actually rule out this case by requiring, so what is the symmetry on the enlarged space? We require the symmetry to be symmetry tensor identity.
See, okay.
Does that make sense?
Not yet, but we'll see when we get to it.
Well, maybe I should. So you're saying this is SPT1, there exists SPT2, which is equivalent to a product state. But this is under the symmetry, so if this has this, I'll call it U1. This is the symmetry for the total system. It's invertible under this symmetry, right?
What should happen?
But it's not invertible under this symmetry. It's kind of subtle. I didn't include all the details here, but on this ancillary space, we require that, like, to define the symmetric unitary, it has to be symmetric with respect to this second type and not this first type. So you can't immediately just invert the phase and then make it trivial.
If that's not, if that's non-trivial, then I can add more and more, and I can, even with this U1 close I symmetry, I can create infinite family of non-trivial SPD. But that's...
Which I have to.
So, what the ancillary space? It's just anything you like. There's no restrictions on it. You just allow to tensorin additional local degrees of freedom to your state, and then pick any classical Hamiltonian on that enlarged system. So it's more like a technicality. I think, this is the more intuitive definition. It's just, we get a circuit, we get a classical state. How close can we get to our SPT state? But that's the more formal definition. Right. So the first result that we have is that SPT models protected by this on-site symmetries are not thermally stable. So what I mean by on-site symmetries is this, it's a slight generalization on Ising type symmetries, so spin flip side type symmetry. We have a local action of our symmetry, and then the global action is just given by the product of all these local actions in the same way. So that Z2 cross Z2 symmetry in the 1D cluster state, that's an on-site symmetry. And these are the typical types of symmetries you think about for SPT phases. And then, as I mentioned, SPT phases with on-site symmetries are kind of classified by group cohomology. And so this is the class of states that we prove the above statement for. So we say, if you take any group cohomology model and then turn up the temperature at all, then the state becomes log depth trivial with epsilon that's polynomially small in the system size. And this works for any dimension. So if I take a group cohomology model, look at the Gibbs state, then I can find a log depth unitary that maps it polynomially close to a classical ensemble. So this says that, at least for the models that we normally look at, they don't form stable phases at equilibrium at non-zero temperature. And I can give you the sketch of the proof. It's pretty straightforward, apart from like finer details, but the overall picture I think is hopefully clear. So if we consider a 2D system with a Ising type symmetry, this will be the easiest to convey the idea. So the model is defined on a triangular lattice with qubits on vertices. And then we have some Hamiltonian, which is some local terms. The details don't matter. It's just terms that act on, actually, these seven spins here. And they're all commuting. That part is kind of important, but yeah, they're all commuting. And then you have this symmetry, which is the Ising type symmetry, flip all the spins. And then when we have no boundaries on the system, we have a unique gapped ground state that respects the symmetry. And then by choice of these
these Hamiltonian terms in the group cohomology formalism. It just prints out these terms. This state belongs to a non-trivial SPT phase. So we can't find some local unitary that's also symmetric that maps our Hamiltonian to a product state. However, we know that in the absence of a symmetry, we should be able to find such unitary because it's short-range entangled. And so the idea is kind of to introduce holes, which I'll define in a minute, but they're really just missing terms in the Hamiltonian, to such that we can approximate our state well, but such that we can also get around this symmetric constraint. So we want to introduce holes to somehow avoid this symmetry constraint and then find a local unitary which maps out our state to a product state or a classical state. And that's this first technical tool here, which is called the imperfect Hamiltonian, and it's appeared before, first in Hastings. And so we take our Hamiltonian, which is the sum of local terms, and then we think about throwing out terms with some probability. So we just remove them from the Hamiltonian with some probability P, which depends on the temperature that we're looking at. So this P is 0 at 0 temperature, and it's 1 at infinite temperature. So we throw out some terms with probability P, and then we get this imperfect Hamiltonian. And then the first technical result is that the ground space of this thing, because we've thrown out terms, so we get degeneracy proportional to exponential in the number of terms that we throw out. The ground space of this, so the uniform mixture of all the ground space ground states, approximates this Gibbs ensemble of the original Hamiltonian very well, up to polynomial error, like inverse polynomial error. So this is kind of what's depicted here. We take our triangular lattice, and then we've just thrown some terms out with probability P. And then notice that at zero temperature, we've thrown out no terms, so the ground space of this is the ground state, the SPT state, and the zero temperature Gibbs state will be also the ground state, so that agrees at zero temperature. And then at infinite temperature, we've thrown out all the terms, the Hamiltonian is just a scalar, and the Gibbs state will be the maximum mixed state. So it agrees in these two limits, and somehow this imperfect Hamiltonian allows us to interpolate between these two. Right. So now we construct the disentangler on this imperfect Hamiltonian. So first we divide the lattice up into a grid, each with logarithmically many qubits. So these are square root of log side lengths. And then, based on this probability that I wrote down earlier, there's a high chance of having a missing term in each square region. And then around each of these missing terms, I just construct this local unitary which maps my Hamiltonian terms to a non-interacting paramagnetic term. And then I can just keep going and just removing all of the terms around it. And then after, there's log spins in each region. And the range of each unitary, if I give like a crude upper bound, is square root of log. And so this gives a logarithmic disentangler, or order logarithmic disentangler. And then once I've disentangled this imperfect Hamiltonian, this correspondingly gives me a low depth preparation of the Gibbs state. So that's kind of the idea. You just approximate it and then construct a disentangler. It's pretty straightforward. But then you can generalize this procedure to arbitrary dimension using properties of these group cohomology models. But really, the tools are just the same. And so what does this say? It says that at zero temperature, we have stable SPT phase of matter. They're robust to some perturbations that commute with the symmetry. But then as soon as we turn up the temperature, we don't have a stable phase of matter. And so how does this sit with us? Is this the end of the story, or perhaps we have to look beyond group cohomology? I mean, based on this correspondence earlier between measurement-based quantum computation and SPT states, we know that there are thermal resources for measurement-based quantum computation, and perhaps there's some connection there. So that leads us to the next part of the talk, which we'll kind of switch gears a bit. So we're going to look beyond group cohomology, but because we don't know of any models outside of the formalism that are protected by on-site symmetries, we look for these so-called higher form symmetries. But we'll talk about that in a minute. So this is the next result. We'll find a stable SPT phase and then try and connect it to fault-tolerant quantum computation. Right, so what is the model that we'll be looking at to show the existence of a stable phase? It's the topological formulation of measurement-based quantum computation, and I'll just call that the Rausendorf scheme from now on. And so the idea is it's really based on this 3D cluster state as the substrate for the computation. And so it's really, the idea behind the computation is really to simulate the braiding of defects in the toric code. So if we take a 2D toric code, you can put punctures in it and encode qubits in this way. So I can have two types of holes, I'll just call them E holes or M holes, and each pair of holes encodes a qubit. And then by braiding these punctures or holes, I can perform gates. And so the 3D cluster scheme is really based on trying to simulate this process. So we have a 3D lattice. We can think of one direction as simulated time. And then through measurements, I can print out defects and then braid them. Well, I can, these are the weld lines. I can print out their weld lines through measurements alone. And then this scheme has a very high threshold, but importantly, I can't perform all of the gates in this way, in a topological way. I can only do X preparations, Z preparations, and measurements, of course, and the C naught gate. So this braid here gives rise to the C naught gate. And so to achieve universality, I have to use non-topological operations such as state injection. But this is really the basic, the idea behind the scheme, the real like base behind the scheme. But why is it so good? Well, in somehow it combines the fault tolerant properties of the 2D toric code and then the measurement based ability of the cluster state scheme. Somehow you get a really high threshold scheme. But what is the physical principle behind this? Because this topological part, this braiding of defects, you can do with the thermal state. You don't need the exact cluster state. You can prepare a Gibbs state and then do the same procedure, do some error correction, and you can still do this topological part of the scheme. But the Gibbs state doesn't go through any phase transition. If I turn up the temperature, it acts as a non-interacting paramagnet, so there's no thermodynamic phase transition. So what is the real physical principle behind this? And so, of course, we're going to explore this through the lens of SPT phases. So what is the model? It's it's a cluster model. You consider a cubic lattice with qubits on faces and qubits on edges. I've labeled them green and blue. But they're really, these qubits are on the same footing, because I can map all of the green qubits to the blue ones just by a translation in each of the unit directions, or alternatively through a lattice duality. So they're on the same footing, even though they might not look like it in this picture. And then the Hamiltonian is the sum of cluster terms, each of them five-body. So this first one, I have an X here, and then Z on the surrounding qubits. And then for the blue-type qubits, I have an X on them, and then Z's on the incident faces. They all commute. There's a unique ground state, the cluster state, which satisfies all of these. It's the plus one eigenstate of all of these stabilizers. And similarly to the 1D case, it has a constant depth preparation. So I prepare all the states in the plus, do CZ between neighboring qubits, such as this, and then I have my cluster state. So it belongs to a trivial phase without a symmetry. However, it enjoys many symmetries, and the important one here is this so-called higher form symmetry or one form symmetry. So what is this one form symmetry? Well, it kind of sounds complicated, but it's not. It's just I choose a two-dimensional surface, so codimension one, that's where the one comes from, surface has to be closed, and then I have a symmetry operator on those surfaces. So a simple example is this. It's elementary one-form operator. It's just the six x's on the faces surrounding the cube. That's a two-dimensional surface. And then we have one for each color. And you can check that they commute with a Hamiltonian because I can form this operator by taking products of all of the cluster terms around the faces, and then all of the z parts cancel, and I'm just left with this operator. So it's symmetry of the Hamiltonian. I can generate any two-dimensional surface in this way by just taking products of these elementary operators. And they naturally arise in this Rausendorf scheme to do error correction. Right. So the claim is that this is the state that underpins the Rausendorf scheme. It's fault tolerant. And the claim is that this state is SPT ordered under the one-form symmetry. But importantly, we won't enforce this one-form symmetry as like a rigid constraint. We allow the processes which break the symmetry, but then we can return to the symmetric sector later through error correction. So it's my plan is to show this correspondence through use of this order parameter. So I'll define some order parameter, and it will tell me that my state belongs to a non-trivial phase, and it also tells me that the topological part of the computation is fault tolerant. So we can define families of these order parameters, and you just choose them by specifying some 2D surface with a boundary. And then two examples here that we'll use for the purpose of this talk are given here. This M1 is just a sheet of X operators on the blue qubits. And then this one is a sheet of green qubits, a sheet of X's on the green qubits with some string of Z's on the boundary. And you can check that these operators are just products of the cluster terms. So they belong to the stabilizer group. And we don't just take the kind of raw expectation value of these operators. We allow for some error correction, where the error correction is measurement of these one-form operators and then some recovery map that depends on the measurement outcomes. So this is the order parameter that we look at. We just sum these two sheets. Then we allow the error-corrected state, and we take the expectation value. The hub is just normalization, such that this value lies between minus 1 and 1. And somehow, when we take these sheets very large, this will be some number which is an invariant, and it can be used to distinguish our SPT trivial and SPT non-trivial phases. So firstly, we show that the order parameter is basically zero for the trivial phase. So these are commuting operators, they belong to the stabilizer group. But if I look at any region on a boundary, such as this kind of slice here, the restriction of the operators to this slice, they anti-commute there. I have some string of z's there, some string of x's there, some string of z's there, and they anti-commute. So if I imagine taking some product state, how high can the expectation value be? Well, it can't simultaneously be a joint eigenstate of this guy and of this guy because they anti-commute. That's really the simple idea behind it. Then you can kind of go a bit further and show that any SPT trivial state needs depth at least on the order L to be a joint eigenstate of these two boundaries. And so if we have R epsilon trivial state with R smaller than L and epsilon small enough, then we know that we're in the trivial phase. So if we have an R epsilon trivial state with R less than epsilon, R less than L and epsilon small enough, then we know that the order parameter must be close to zero. That's what I would say.
Where did the triviality come into this argument?
So if I allow myself some short depth unitary on, say, a product state, I still can't make my state a joint eigenstate of these anti-commuting boundaries. So you can gain all your intuition from just a pure product state with a short depth unitary, and then you can just without too much difficulty lifted to these Gibbs states. And then because the error correction is just measurement of one form operators, we remain within the symmetric space, and we can't improve this. And now, so trivial states have small values. Now we just show that the cluster phase has large values of this order parameter. And so it turns out that if we start with the exact cluster state, we know it's a plus one under the either of those operators, because it belongs to the stabilizer group. So the order parameter is one for the zero temperature state. And if I take the Gibbs state, it just looks like a cluster state, but with some chains of Z errors. So what I do is I measure these one-form operators, and they tell me, when I measure these one-form operators, they tell me about the boundary of these chains. And so I can see these red circles here. This is the physical error chain that's happened through thermal errors, but now I can see these boundaries. And my error correction tries to match these two errors up. And then I'll be in the plus one eigenspace of all these one-form operators. And then we say the correction succeeds if we don't form a non-trivial cycle wrapping around the lattice. Because if we're in this case, then each of these sheet operators will be plus one, because Z operators intersect the sheet twice, and so they commute. They're not harmful. But a string that wraps from top to the bottom will anti-commute with our sheet order parameter, and that will ruin the order. And then you can show that the error correction works below some critical temperature. You map it to a stat-mech model and then check for a phase transition. It's the same protocol as the 3D toric code. But the physical mechanism behind this is confinement. These errors aren't allowed to wander too far because they have a large energy cost. And so then you can show that the order parameter takes values near one, provided we're below this critical temperature, which means it's a proof for the non-trivial SPT order. Okay. And then the second part, I'll try and go through this pretty quickly, but the motivation behind these order parameters or these operators is really through the Rousendorf scheme. It's these operators quantify the ability to localize EPR pairs. So if I think of this state here, this slice here is a 2D toric code, and same with this slice, and I measure single qubit X measurements in the bulk, I can, if the expectation value is near one, then I can infer this post measurement expectation values of the toric code string operator. So this X is a toric code string operator here, the second one is up here. And these correlations are that of a EPR pair. So the order parameter tells us that we can generate maximally entangled states. And then we can, of course, do the same error correction game. And then you can take different geometries of these operators to test all the other things that you want to test, like how do I do braids, and how do I do other teleportation, and so on. So that's the connection there. And then, so the real picture behind all this that makes it work is that measurement errors, when I do single qubit measurements, I can consider them as perfect measurements, but with a thermal error that happened beforehand. But we already know that we can correct for thermal errors. And so we can do the error correction in one single step. Normally you would need multiple rounds of error correction to figure out where our faulty measurements are as opposed to our physical errors. But here we only need one round, and that's really key to the scheme working, because we only get one shot. We do single qubit measurements, and then that burns off our qubits. And then a second observation something you might notice is that it seems like this definition of SPT order is protocol dependent, because we use error correction in the definition of our order parameter. But if you choose maximum likelihood decoding, which is the optimal decoder, it becomes protocol independent. But it seems like for defining
SPT order at non-zero temperature, and indeed topological order at non-zero temperature. Seems like you can't really get away with it with not thinking about error correction. It seems very intimately related. So Hastings' argument for the 4D Torrey code stability relies on having the ability to do error correction, and then he defines some operators in a similar way. So error correction seems intimately related with these condensed matter ideas. And so that's the end of the talk. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for sitting around for so long. But yeah. So what did we show? We proved that these group cohomology models are unstable at any non-zero temperature. And then we tried to we showed the existence of a stable SPT phase, namely this 3D cluster state that's used in the measurement based scheme. And then related the SPT order to this fault tolerant properties. And so the take home is really that these high form symmetries seem very key to thermal stability. They allow you to do error correction, and they seem key to fault tolerance. And so it seems like this is the correspondence that should be true for non-zero temperature. So we really want SPT states to be stable at non-zero temperature for good resources for measurement-based quantum computation. And then to finalize, what are some further questions that we might think about? Well, it would be nice to relate this definition to even more operational features and see if we can prove something for a class of states, like whether some class of higher form symmetric SPT states are useful for measurement-based quantum computation. And this is analogous to the question of whether topological order at non-zero temperature means that the system is self-correcting and vice versa. That seems true for every case that you check. It's true for the 4D Torrey code, has topological order at non-zero temperature and it's self-correcting. And then 2D Torrey code, which is unstable, or even 3D models like Haas code, they have no topological order at non-zero temperature. But I don't know if anything's proven about that correspondence. And then, of course, there's a rich variety of other higher form SPTs in 3D that you might look at, and they seem to have some pretty nice properties, so they look like good candidates for fault-tolerant measurement-based quantum computation. And then, on the other side of things, as I mentioned, you only get the C0 gate through this braiding, and then you should be able to measure in other defects, like twist defects, and get better gates, because Benji has shown that through braiding of twist defects and punctures, you can get all of the Clifford's. So we couldn't even get Clifford's by braiding punctures in the Rousenov scheme, so we need state injections even for Clifford gates, which is kind of wasteful, but I think, yeah, twists seem to work anyway in the Rousenov scheme. And then the Rousenov scheme is really based on the 2D Torrey code. It's called a foliation of the 2D Torrey code, and you can do it for other CSS codes like the color code, and perhaps you get better gates that you can do by braiding. And it's kind of similar to the question of what type of gates you can get through defects. How does that relate to what type of transversal gates you have in the code? I don't know what is known about that correspondence. That seems pretty interesting. And then, of course, we don't have to consider the Gibbs state. We can try and prevent our system from thermalizing, and there's lots of interesting ideas like pre-thermalization, maybe some time-driven systems, periodically driven systems. And then, lastly, I think this is always an interesting question, try and understand the physics of the 3D gauge color code, and maybe this one-form symmetry provides some lens to study it through. But that's my talk, so thanks very much for sitting around.
Excellent, I heard many. Okay. do you see any way of considering the problem of whether or not the byproduct operators are efficiently classically computable? This is an important point, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if you have a universal resource state if you can't calculate the byproduct operator.
So if you use a Abelian quantum double, it should be efficient?
Yeah, but I mean, more generally, right? I mean, you have a scheme that says, here's some kind of SPT order.
Yep.
We're connecting it to MPQC.
Right.
But it's not really MPQC if you can't do your classical computation. Like, somehow, I don't know where you're smuggling something in.
Byproduct, what?
Sorry?
What is byproduct? What is
like, the parity equals the compute at the end to, like,
you have all these plus minus one measurement outcomes. You have to compute some parity function to figure out, like, the classical correction to your. Right? I mean, could have a different resource state in which you can do all the same stuff, but you can't efficiently compute this correction.
You know, in the 1D cluster state, you do the measurements, and then you do a local parity correction. That's like the parity of all the measurement outcomes.
Actually, you have exactly the same physics, except you can't compute what correction you need to do.
You need like a, yeah, it's not efficient.
I should get this.
So okay, so here the important point is that we can make a Bell state between these two things, right? And we can efficiently compute which Bell state it is. But imagine you can make a Bell state, but you can't compute which one it is efficiently.
Okay.
So this is not particularly useful to us.
Right.
But still, somehow has a lot of the same physics.
Right.
Do you have any idea as to how we should distinguish these two cases, right? Because it's very important for MPQC, but somehow the physics is.
So you say, like, in this case, for some reason, we can create this correct variable.
Yeah, somehow the error correction that you need to do at the end is classically tractable. But this need not be the case. But, I mean, a lot of the physics would be exactly the same. I think it's...
Yeah.
Do you have any idea for how to separate this?
Yeah, it's not exactly clear where that comes into the framework where it naturally would sit. But I don't know. Can you do... not a billion higher form symmetries, or is that?
No,
maybe
higher form
symmetries like naturally excluded or something. I don't know, I think it's an interesting point.
Yeah.
It just.
There's an argument why it is not possible in a standard definition, but maybe you can avoid consult something.
I mean, it won't be a product symmetry around the boundary. It'll be a Pipo symmetry. Like, it won't be a... So, I mean, you have, you know, like a 2D...
Yeah,
you have a 2D surface on which there's a product symmetry, right? I think in the non-abelian case, it'll be a 2D symmetry that's a Pipo symmetry. It won't be a product symmetry on this surface.
Yeah.
I think this is possible.
I forgot the exact argument, but... I think there is a kind of semi-formal argument why it shouldn't be the case.
I believe that it couldn't be the case with product symmetries.
Product, okay. But you want to have some complicated symmetry.
I don't know.
No, on-site, actually.
Yeah, not even on-site on the manifold.
It doesn't even have to be like LU or anything, right? If you're using Pipo symmetries, it can be like pretty complicated. Okay.
So you still think it's a local
unitary
circuit?
Or low depth circuit? It doesn't make sense if it's not a low depth
circuit. Well, it does as long as it's low depth, like as long as its action can be approximated by a low depth circuit on the correct subspace.
Okay.
I mean,
that would be okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, so I think for all the example of a locality preserving gate or symmetries, even if it's not written in the on-site form, there is a way to massage the original code or model so that symmetry becomes on-site for all the known models. So
I think this is 2D, right?
2D, yeah.
Yeah, any non-anomalous anion symmetry can be made on site for 2D models, but you're probably thinking about 3D anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have other questions.
Good
slides.
I
can't have more slides for my
kind of.
Oh, maybe it's on. Maybe this page. Oh yeah. Okay. So. You reckon if you use maximum likelihood decoding, then this is protocol independent. So that would, do you have a proof that if T is above this critical temperature of the random plicate gauge model, that your trivially ordered?
I don't think so. It's not rigorous, but I mean, I think it is trivial above this critical temperature, but so imagine instead of...
I believe you, I was just asking if you had...
Yeah, I think it's still...
It's difficult to improve these things.
Because actually, if you change your model kind of slightly, and imagine instead of allowing arbitrary thermal errors, you only allowed one form symmetric ones. It's like a very tough constraint, but if that happens, then the critical temperature rises a little bit because you never have to do the error correction. They're just, it's whether you're in the confined phase or not, that's when your water parameter is satisfied. And so there's some slight...
The Rennet-Picquet gauge?
Say again, sorry?
Confined phase of Rennet-Picquet gauge?
Yeah, but it would be like the non-random. It would just be the Z2 gauge theory.
It's still like even at the finite high temperature phase, strictly speaking, we don't have any algorithm or way of approximating that gives us some. I mean, I feel that there must exist, but I cannot come up with a simple one. So this imperfect Hamiltonian trick works only when all the terms are almost independent. So the number of redundancies will be sub-polynomial in the number of system size, then it works, but so it's a bit tricky.
Can you take any of these symmetries through like static dualities to try and attack this problem?
That's probably so, but in that case, how does it do? In that case, we need to do the high temperature expansion. So,
I think this should be doable.
Yeah, so assuming there is only one transition point.
Well, you wouldn't even need, not necessarily even show that, you just like you take a high temperature, low temperature duality and then show that the new model is ordered at low temperature, which means it would be disordered.
Then
it tells you about like one on the inverse critical temperature, right? It doesn't tell you slightly above the critical temperature unless you only have one phase transition.
I don't know, but I mean, if you don't know even how to say it, it's arbitrarily large and finite.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, yeah, and on this question I was going to ask about, on the very last point I was going to ask about this Hastings paper about percolation thresholds and error correction and critical thermodynamic temperatures thing. Does that have any comment? Do you know what paper I'm talking about? Like this one, is it Hastings Bradley?
Yeah, Hastings South
Roger. Oh yeah, Hastings Mountains. Like where they look at, I mean, high dimensional torque codes,
mm-hmm.
and you show that, oh yeah, it's the same as Benny's paper about a clock model. I mean...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know in detail, but I have looked at it before.
I mean, so all of these arguments for error correction based on statistical mechanics and like these self-correcting models, they're basically some variant of Pale's argument, right? Pale's argument works up to when the air is percolating.
Yes,
but that's not necessarily the same point at which the thermodynamic phase transition is. And in high-dimensional models, there's provably a gap.
Yeah, you mean like higher spin local dimension?
You can do that for clock models, or higher physical dimension in Ising models, or torque
yes.
or whatever, these are both of these cases.
Yeah, it's like you can't prove that.
Yeah, there's like this hysteresis thing that goes up.
So, I mean, you show... These the thresholds, maximum likelihood threshold, by mapping to a SatMag model, but you don't know if just because you're in the ordered phase, you don't know if like this phase transition corresponds to the real error correction threshold. It's not like a proof or anything. So I guess that's similar to what's going on here, right?
If you know your error model perfectly, then if you know your error model is bit flips, I'm guessing you can prove. The error correction threshold is the same as the critical point in the static model.
It depends on what you do as
well. Well, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, at the level of breakaway, this, what's the name for this point?
Yeah.
But I think about the population threshold, it's, I think, very difficult to find the
people in part.
The heat bar,
well, I guess that would be okay.
Because it's still got a diverging lifetime, just not, well, okay, we think it's still got a diverging lifetime, just not exponential. We think, I mean, this is true in the clock models as well, right? We think the lifetime still.
It's very difficult. It's not the same in the sense that in the clock model case, it's actually a rigorous thermodynamic transition. So you see some
monadic
something visible in thermodynamic quantities, but in this toroidal case, if you measure everything like energy and specific heat and so on, it's smooth, so you don't see anything.
Right, but we expect that the lifetimes are still diverging in this super percolated but border breaking.
So I think diverging, but I don't know if it's exponential or not, and I don't know if. Even if it's exponential, it could be like e to the l square or e to the l.
So, yeah. But I mean, as long as it's diverging, that means that there's an error correction. I mean, it's correctable in principle.
So I don't know if it's polynomial or exponential. I even don't.
Right. Another question. No, okay, so I just want to clarify what was going on. So I want to consider the situation not where the symmetry on the tensor, like on the double copy space, is the local product symmetry. I want to consider the symmetry group is the product of the two symmetry groups.
So you double the symmetry group?
Square, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then what, is it invertible? Stable?
Non-trivial examples of such. So okay,
yeah.
I want to consider
G times G.
As a group.
As a group.
Yeah. So not like this local tensor product.
Mm-hmm.
Like this S prime is a symmetry because that's an element of G tensor.
And then you also
it's invertible topologically ordered with this like product symmetry rather than this.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Isn't two copies of 1D cluster state? That's an example.
Symmetry on one of the chain, then.
No, okay, I have a G symmetry down here, and I have a G symmetry up here.
Oh, yeah. Then it's trivial.
Now I want to, like, these are separate.
Mm-hmm. Separate reacting, then.
Yeah. And
if
I want
you prepare
that respects, like, the product of this
the
product symmetry group, it makes this trivial.
Yeah, that's pretty doable.
But that means that this S prime is a symmetry.
No. Did I say something wrong? No, I think I said something wrong.
If you do your procedure, G symmetry on the bottom, and then also another G symmetry on top, then it's still non-trivial. It's just the same as stacking.
Not necessarily. I mean, this is not true for
maybe not for everything.
I'm asking if there exist examples.
Yeah, 1D cluster shape should be.
Then it would be trivial under this definition.
An example of a non-trivial.
Or an example of an invertible trivial. Invertible in this sense. Should I write some things in the book?
Trivial one is the G times identity and then two copies.
And then you want
now you want a non-trivial phase here.
Yeah, okay, so, right, I have some
G non-trivial, rho, and then I want to say, does there exist, okay, it's going to be, I'm going to define G invertible GI, S, G symmetric invertible topological order. Okay. Rho is G symmetric invertibly topologically ordered if
yes. Okay.
There exists a sigma such that right, so this has there is a sigma, and then sigma such that there's some other like VG tensor and sigma equals sigma, and
the new group generator
gap rho tensor sigma VG,
yeah,
and U G tensor M tensor V H.
Yeah. And this is the new group.
Well,
G H. This is like the new SPT. This is the new group, and we want to know if this is non-trivial under this.
Right. So this is for the G and G, and this is for this is H and G also. So this is, G plus G.
Yeah. And the question is this thing, do there exist examples of such things?
Right.
Where this is trivial under this and non-trivial under this?
This is, okay, so this is non-trivial. Oh, and it can't be.
Yeah, not true. Just
right. Okay, where this is trivial respecting the symmetry.
You wanna know an example when it's trivial.
Okay.
I thought you asked the converse question a bit. Are there non-trivial ones? And the answer, I think, is yes. But then are there trivial ones?
I want a thing such that is... Okay, so here's invertible topological order in the long-range set. It's my template.
Yeah.
I have a topological order state. Can't be locally disentangled. Does there exist another state such that the tensor product can be locally disentangled?
Yeah.
Right, so I want a symmetry respecting the state down here.
Yeah.
Another state that's representing...
Yeah.
That's got a potentially different symmetry, but for the sake of argument, let's say it's got the same group.
Yeah.
And then we put them together, and we have to respect the symmetry of both of them.
Yeah.
Or we can disentangle them to both the truth.
You want to know an invertible. So originally, when you said invertible, I would think of the case where I just have G, and then they're all invertible.
Yes. But I want this case. Because this is the case where it's plausibly called, I mean, if you have a pure state, it would be called non-trivial under, like, pure state SPT definition. But under this mixed state definition, it would be called trivial.
Yeah. Well, I think at least in one day, you could just do the calculation for group cohomology and just see what is H2 of G cross G compared to H2 of G, and then see if it grows or if it shrinks, then you know there has to be some invertible phase.
Is that obvious?
Well,
so what's the statement we need?
Okay, so
does it exist?
If I have a non-trivial SPT with
okay.
G,
yeah.
Can I find another SPT sigma, which is also an SPT under G, such that the tensor of the two is trivial under G cross G?
You want to put sigma only on the other side of the system?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Well, there exist examples where the group is identity, then. That's the point.
Why? Well,
because there exist invertible, like long range invertible topological order cases.
Sure, but it doesn't comply with this
one. Well, that's a symmetry group
by group identity.
Oh, the identity. Oh, okay.
Well, okay, I mean, technically it's SET or whatever, but still. It strongly leads me to suspect that there could potentially be, in some dimension, examples that are non-trivial like this.
Was this kind of formula? I have to relate this to this?
Yes. I don't have to.
I don't remember the exact expression. Actually, let me check.
Symmetry G cross G, and if we put log times sigma.
But it is if G is identity.
If G is identity. Yeah, but the point is, we are assuming log and sigma are non-trivial under group cohomology G. Then. It's just
actually, I would be happy even if sigma didn't have to be SVT. Sigma can be arbitrary.
Sure.
Yeah. That, well, that, for the, this thing, that's what you're interested in.
Yeah. It's just that the representation of this symmetry group only acts on the first factor. And that's all you need to compete with.
I don't know, so, but there are, I think, many different ways of arguing it. But one way is just, I mean, this is not the, maybe I can bring it more rigorous, but suppose G is just some bosonic unitary symmetries. Then if I gauge this system, then I will get the quantum double model with G cross G symmetries. And then it has a braiding statistics, S matrices and so on, which is different from the one you would get by gauging the trivial one.
Can you gauge to an ITO phase state?
Sure.
Can you gauge into an ITO state?
I'm gauging G symmetric. I'm not gauging
I symmetric. No, I know. Right. So, like you just said, we take some G symmetric state and we gauge it into a long range topologically ordered state, which has some. So I want to take some other SPT state and gauge into some invertible topologically ordered state instead of a quantum double state or something.
What is the canonical example for like a long range invertible phase?
EA.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how to write, do anything with, but
but EA is.
So,
I mean, math people know more examples, but I don't.
Yeah, yeah, but even if E8 is, it exists, this argument is about SPT and the G symmetry. That part is, E8 is something you attach. So, attaching E8 wouldn't change the I mean, it doesn't affect the classification.
No, I want to find some SPT state that gauges, that when you gauge it, becomes EA.
Sure.
Is that obviously impossible? I guess that's my question.
I mean,
engaging
EA, but EA doesn't have any topological excitation, so
yes.
There is nothing to engage. So EA is, I think, just EA.
Okay, yeah, all ITFAs have to have no topological.
So, but wait, I mean, you can gauge things and then get non-anionic excitations.
Yeah, but I can't have any.
You can just feel yourself aggregating.
Well, trivial stuff is the toric code.
No, I mean, even like, non-topologically, it's, you gauge, at least when you gauge, say, higher form symmetries, right?
Let's consider.
Yeah, but I think it might be true for on-site symmetries too, maybe.
No. If I gauge on-site symmetry,
you get a lattice gauge theory, which is going to be at the.
Well, so yeah, that's a trivial thing. It could be possible, right?
I mean, what if you don't start with like a paramagnet or something, and you start with?
Yeah. If you start with paramagnet or Ising model and then gauge it, then you get something to you. But I think the point is that in this discussion, if I gauge J symmetries and I get some model on them, when I classify phases, I use grading statistics and so on. So I use anion properties, which are immune to E8 additions. So for that reason, I think
right.
It should be fine.
Okay, that's kind of
convincing.
Yeah, that's
cool. I mean, from the MPS perspective, though, is it kind of, it seems like in 1D I can't have this GSITO because
many just argued you can't have it in anything.
Yeah, but like rigorously in 1D, you can probably say that you can't have it. Like very.
What is partial dimension? Yeah, maybe. I don't know much about it.
If nothing interesting exists in one space of dimension.
Gauging trick works only from 2D.
Yeah, what happens if you try and gauge high form symmetries? How do you do this?
Sorry?
Is it no? Like, what happens when you gauge high form symmetries?
You get. So let's say, let's think about for the
spatial dimensions,
and if you gauge the zero form on-site symmetry, you get the toric code with point-like excitations. If you gauge one form symmetry, then you get the toric code, which is the self-correcting.
How do you gauge the one form symmetry?
I guess, well, in 3D, if you start with degrees of freedom here, and you gauge it, I have like G here and H here. This is on states, this is a map on states, so it's basis states. It's much to like G inverse H. But you basically just take the code boundary of this configuration.
It's always code boundary.
And then if you have a one form model, maybe it's better if I could. Now my degrees of freedom are here, and here, G, H. Well, yeah, let's go A, B, C, D. This thing becomes A, B, C, D, with the right orientations and the curve boundary again.
Cool.
And then you lift that to operators and whatever, and just